This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This nation's biggest trading partner is the country just across our northern border. Indeed, Canada and the United States are the world's largest trading partners and share the world's largest unprotected border. We share the same mother country. We also share a common language, although our spelling and pronunciations sometimes differ. In fact, we have many things in common and certainly share similar economic challenges. This message of two countries with mutual interest is the one that was laid out yesterday for Charlotte's World Affairs Council by the Ambassador of Canada to the United States, Michael Wilson. Ambassador Wilson was appointed in 2006. He has also been a member of the Canadian House of Commons and was once Canadian Minister of Finance, Minister for International Trade, and Minister of Industry, Science, and Technology. And prior to becoming ambassador to the United States, Mr. Wilson also served as chairman of UBS Canada and worked for an organization that many Charlottians are familiar with, RBC Financial Group, which has a sister operation in town, RBC Bank, which I'm told is the largest Canadian employer in North Carolina.
That's correct.
Well, that's the voice of Michael Wilson, who joins us for the hour. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike. Great to be with you.
You, as I just said, were in Charlotte to speak on Thursday to the World Affairs Council about Canada's partnership with the United States in the changing global economy. And that economy is unquestionably in tatters at the moment. And you spent time in your career on Bay Street, which I guess is Canada's Wall Street, as an investment executive prior to your movement into government and intermittently since then, and were at one time, as I said, Minister of Finance. And according to Fareed Zakaria of Newsweek, Canada is alone in the industrialized world in not facing a single bank failure. You've had no calls for bailouts or government intervention in the financial or the mortgage sector. Has that changed?
No, it hasn't changed. Each of our banks have been able to raise capital from traditional sources, private investors, institutional investors, but not having to go to the government. What the government has, though, been asked to do, and they have done it, is to put the banks on a level playing field where other governments have guaranteed loans or deposits with their banks. In particular, the deposits. Our banks have been put on a competitive disadvantage, and they found cases they've lost deposits to government-guaranteed banks. So the government has said, we will guarantee deposits, and they've also provided some liquidity when liquidity is dried up for these reasons.
Where did you go right? Because your financial system is the healthiest now in the world, I would think, in the industrialized world.
Well, the World Economic Forum has done a study of the international banks, and they said that, their words, the Canadian banking system is the soundest banking system in the world of the ones that they have reviewed. I won't go into a lot of detail on this because it's a fairly complex story. One of the things the bank regulator has done is put an absolute limit of leverage of deposits relative to equity capital. And they said, forget about Basel II, which has different types of capital that qualify. They said, only equity, raw equity capital. That has meant that that was 20-to-1 ratio. Our banks have kept it down to an 18-to-1 ratio. The U.S. banks have been 25 plus. Mm-hmm. The London banks have been in around 30. Some of the Europeans higher. Some have even close to 40 times. So because we don't have that same leverage and because we've had a more regulated mortgage system, the Canadian banks have been able to run their businesses in a way that they can remain competitive, but also keep a healthy balance sheet.
So I was going to ask you, obviously this is helping you in the down times because you were conservative, but did it hurt you in the good times when everybody else was making money hand over fist?
Well, it's interesting. When you look at the bottom line, our economy didn't suffer from that. Our economy still continued to be at the upper end of the range, number one or number two of the G7 countries. So we didn't suffer in that sense. Yes, they probably missed out on some business. So the profitability of the banks was less than it might have been had they taken more risk during that up period.
You were also one of the last, or I think the last, of the G8 countries to go into this current recession. Even though you've experienced no bank failures, you must be going through some problems, because you said that Canadian taxpayers want accountability for Canada's unprecedented recovery efforts. Why do you need those efforts?
Well, we are in recession.
Right.
We went into recession, we believe, in the last quarter. The economists won't say that officially until we see what comes in this quarter just ended. But in anticipation of what everybody expects is going to be the case, the government in the last budget in January this year had a significant stimulus package of an order of magnitude that was suggested by the IMF, and the IMF have commented positively on the Canadian package. So we have cut spending. Cut taxes, but also there's stimulus spending on things like infrastructure, some R&D related to climate change. So we've done those sorts of things, and that means that we should be able to address the weakness that we have now, but it's not the weakness to the extent that some other countries have enjoyed or have felt.
Must not be as terrible on your citizens as it is on some of ours, because the U.S. lost over 2 million jobs last year. Canada gained jobs, I am told.
Marginal, about 100,000 jobs, you're right. But I have to put everything on the table. In the first 2 months of this year, we had significant job loss. And that, so there's kind of a bit of a catch-up. How we look at ourselves here, Mike, is that we are about, we're about the tenth of the size in population of the United States, and we're about 1/13th, 1/14th the size of the economy of the United States. 30% of our economy is exports to the United States. Mm-hmm. So if you have a recession, it's very hard, almost impossible for us, particularly something as serious as we're all going through. We can't avoid it. We can't shield ourselves from
that. And we'll get to some hard numbers on that in a little while, because we are a key trading partner here in North Carolina with Canada. And if we're not trading, then you're hurting, and vice versa, I suppose. But I also read today that Canada has less household indebtedness than the United States. Talk to me about Canadians. How did that? You're right across the border. You're inundated with television from the United States, which is we're a consumer society here in this country. Maybe you are in Canada, but you seem to be more responsible than we are, more adult, more grown up.
We are a consumer society, but not to the extent.
And why not?
Well, let me give you a very fundamental reason. We don't have mortgage deductibility, so we don't have that incentive to go out and buy a little bit bigger house than we should, so we can afford the house we buy, because we can't spend too much money on it. The other thing is that a lot of banks will lend mortgage money against a house without recourse to the borrower. So if you cancel the mortgage, you can walk away with it, with some hit to your credit rating, but you can do that. We can't. So the result is that the Canadian who is borrowing that money is going to say, look, I could get wiped out if my house goes bad. So we have these things that are built into our system that has caused us to keep our indebtedness down. You know, it still went up during this period. I don't want to avoid that. It did go up, but it wasn't up to the same extent. So we haven't had the run-up in house prices in the big years, but we haven't had the run-down in house prices in recent years.
Our guest is Michael Wilson, who is Canada's ambassador to the United States here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council here in Charlotte. The reason we do things with housing the way we do them, we are told, is because it's the American dream to own your own home in the suburbs with the picket fence. What is the Canadian dream?
It's not much different, but let me just give you a very interesting number here. House ownership, home ownership in the United States is 68% of the population. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same number in Canada.
Really?
So our house prices in some cases are lower. So there's an affordability element here that is reflected in that.
Do your citizens look across the border longingly and pine for the homeownership or mortgage deduction?
I can't say, if you ask them, would you like to be able to, sure, they're going to say, I'd love to have it. But, I mean, I was in my first year, the first time I came into government back in 1979, one of the things we talked about but never got around to doing it because we lost the government very quickly, far too quickly, was mortgage deductibility. And there was quite a debate within the country as to whether that was the right way for us to go.
What do you think now?
I think that we were probably right not having it.
Okay. At one point, you were the chairman of UBS Canada. That's a big bank or a big financial institution out of Switzerland, UBS AG, headquartered in Switzerland. And they've gotten themselves into trouble in recent years financially and with U.S. law. What went wrong there and in so many of these other major institutions that seem to be getting us all into hot water? What went wrong?
I think that one of the fundamental things that went wrong was a strategic decision on the part of the top management in Switzerland, in Zurich, to aggressively increase their presence in the United States. And that decision was transmitted to the people who were running the businesses here, particularly on the investment banking side in the United States, to say, we want to be competitive. We want to increase our footprint in this market. And unfortunately, it happened at the time when some of the other practices that we've heard about, the subprime structured loans, things like that, were happening. So the people in the investment bank down here really built up their share of that business, and unfortunately it was at the wrong time.
You're a diplomat, so I know you're not going to give me an honest answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because a lot of the financial problems of the world emanate from the United States, because we got a little carried away, we got a little careless, we got a little greedy, we got a little... we screwed up, and the rest of the world is suffering. When you look across the border at the United States, when others look across the ocean at the United States, are we taking a lot of blame? Are people angry at us for this?
I will answer. I think I'm answering this question quite honestly. There is, I understand, that sort of attitude from other countries. Mm-hmm. I've heard political leaders in those other countries express that point of view. I have not heard it myself. Now, I'm living in Washington. I do talk to people in Canada. I visit Canada. But I have not heard people say, those bad guys down there got us into the mess that we're in today. They don't see it. They see it as a much more of a global issue that, there's contributing factors coming from, a lot of people, a lot of countries. But, I have not heard it specifically as it relates to the United States. That's not to say that there aren't some people who feel that way, but it's not, I don't think, a prevalent feeling.
I have about 10 seconds. Do you think we'll get out of this shortly, soon?
I think it's going to take a while.
Okay.
I think it's going to take a while. I would be looking into next year.
Michael Wilson is our guest. He's Canada's ambassador to the United States, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get back to Charlotte Talks in just a moment. Conversation with Canadian Ambassador Michael Wilson. It was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your phone calls this morning. Programming made possible in part by Dixon Hughes, certified public accountants and advisors, combining the resources of a Southeast-based accounting firm with the responsiveness a personal relationship delivers at dixon-hughes.com. Well, one of the good things that can come out of a recession is that it can be a ripe time for entrepreneurs and their ideas. We'll explore the pros of being an entrepreneur in the current economic climate. That's coming up on Monday here on Charlotte Talks. We'll also take a look at how area institutions are helping these entrepreneurs. That all comes up Monday morning on Charlotte Talks at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Back to this conversation with the Canadian ambassador in just a moment.
The Friday News Roundup. The Attorney General tries to restore confidence in the Justice Department. The Defense Secretary announces cuts to the Pentagon budget. And hackers may have infiltrated the U.S. electric grid. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday.
Join us for the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon today, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins, and we're in conversation in our Spirit Square studio today with Michael Wilson, Canada's ambassador to the United States, who is in town on Thursday to speak to the World Affairs Council because, as you told the World Affairs Council, Canada is North Carolina's top export market. More goods are exported from Canada to North Carolina than to Japan or China or Mexico, and I read also Germany and Great Britain. Is that true?
That's correct.
I had no idea. What do we export? What do you export?
Well, it's a range of things. Transportation products is one thing. Let me just make one point, just to clarify what you've said. It's we export and we import about the same amount. So it's $4.3 billion either way. And it works out to about $1 million an hour.
That's amazing.
It's a lot of business, and we have a major banking presence here, RBC Bank. We have a company called Domtar, which is in the building products business. We have another big company. They make the styrofoam containers that your meat is in the supermarket. So these are things that, there's just a lot of business, nothing that really jumps off the page at you.
And the good news, I suppose, is that it's in both directions.
It's in both directions.
People
right.
in this country get upset because they see our jobs going offshore, and they blame NAFTA for what's happening down south. And there was a similar trade agreement, I've forgotten the name of it all of a sudden, that came about this almost the same time as NAFTA, that opened trade fairly easily between the U.S. and Canada.
Well, what happened was in 1987, we had the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement. Mm-hmm. That was the precursor to NAFTA. Mm-hmm. Then when Mexico and the United States started to talk a little bit about a free trade agreement between the two of them, we said, well, hold on now, why don't we do it and include the three of us? So we used a lot of the things that we had already agreed on in U.S.-Canada and roll it into NAFTA.
And here's something else I don't think most of us, and I could be wrong, but I don't think most of us think about Canada when we think about oil. We think about the Middle East, we think right. about Venezuela, and when gasoline became so expensive last summer, we thought about OPEC, we thought about commodities traders on Wall Street, etc. But the U.S. imports more, you know this because it's in your speech, more oil, gas, electricity, and uranium from Canada than from any other country. We get more oil from Canada than we do from Saudi Arabia or Venezuela combined. So does it worry you when politicians on this side of the border start talking about breaking our cycle of dependence on foreign oil? Because you're foreign to us.
Well, we are. But because we are in Canada, because geographically we're very close, because there are something like 20, more than 20 oil pipelines, more than 30 natural gas pipelines, over 50 electricity interconnects. It's easier for us to have this energy trade than you will have it with any other country. So if you're going to break that dependence, it's going to happen with other countries before it'll happen to us. And I don't think that dependence, it's going to decline, but we're still going to be using oil for a long, long time.
I would think that a lot of your oil, correct me if I'm wrong, is in very difficult to get to places in Canada. It's certainly not in Ottawa. It's not in Montreal. It's got to be way up there, right?
It's not way, way up there. It's in Alberta.
Okay.
But that's like getting oil from Texas for you.
Okay.
We have oil in the offshore East Coast, in offshore Newfoundland. That's not that far away. Pipelines can do marvelous things. We are looking at a pipeline, the two of us, from the north coast, the north slope of Alaska, to bring natural gas down here.
Well, we hear about pipelines in this country, and people get into a tizzy. Environmentalists say it's bad for the animals, it's bad for the land, there could be leaks, there could be all kinds of things that go on. We don't want to open certain parts of Alaska to exploration for oil because of what it might do to the environment and the pristine nature of it all.
Right.
Are Canadian citizens similarly concerned?
Yes, and the Canadian government is concerned. We want to be able to ship our energy to you in as safe a way as possible, looking at it from the standpoint of the environment. There is, let's face it, right head on in this conversation, we have people in the United States who say that the oil that we are shipping to you from our oil sands is got a higher carbon footprint than conventional oil, and maybe we shouldn't be, or maybe you shouldn't be receiving that oil. We recognize that, and we have policies that we're working on now, research projects that we're working on now, to absolutely address that project, concern, and future projects. We have said must have a plan in place to reduce their carbon footprint to zero.
How does Canadian consumption of energy per capita compare to the United States?
I think it's a little higher in the United States, but it's the same order of magnitude. We are both significant consumers of energy.
And do you consume it because it's so cold up there that you got to have heat running 9 months out of the year? Or do you do it through gasoline consumption in automobiles and other forms, or do you know?
I can't be precise and just off the top of my head, Mike, but I would imagine the weather has some impact on it, but we have the same sorts of distances as you have. We have the same structure in our cities as you have. So my guess is that the automotive consumption is not a lot different. The differential in the use of the automobile is that we are more apt to buy smaller cars or energy efficient cars than I believe is the case. I'm sure it's the case. We have SUVs, but we don't have them to the same extent.
Why?
I don't know. It's choice.
Well, there are obviously cultural, despite our common language
cultural,
and common answers here,
that
there are cultural differences.
Yeah, there could be some, I'll own up here. My wife has, it's not a big SUV, but she drives an SUV.
Mm-hmm. In this country or in Canada?
In Canada.
Okay.
Why does she drive it? Because she likes the space to put stuff in the back. I don't have the numbers to give you, but I know for a fact that we have a lower usage of SUVs and light trucks than you do in this.
How involved are you, considering the fact that you do have relatively high energy consumption, and I'm sure a lot of it is to heat needs in the wintertime? How involved is Canada in trying to find and develop alternative sources of energy?
Same sorts of approaches as you have. It's a policy of our government. We are spending money on research projects. One of the things that we're both looking at right now is energy efficient engines, fuel efficient cars, hybrids. This is part of the rescue package for the economy. We have proportionately more automotive production in our country than you do. Proportionately, not in absolute terms. Absolutely, you're way above us, but in proportionate terms, we are higher than you. So it's very important to us to get this automotive rescue package right, and we're working very closely with your government.
We seem to have a military presence all over the world. We seem to be the world's policemen, whether we like it or not. Is it safe to say that Canada is this nation's closest or most important ally in the defense of either the hemisphere or this continent?
Well, certainly this continent. We work very closely. We've been partners in NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a little anecdote here. When the planes were called out of the air at 9/11, the order was given by the deputy commander in NORAD in Colorado Springs, who's Canadian. Wow. So that's gives you some sense of the close nature of the relationship that we have. We have been very close since the Second World War. Our defense production industries are very integrated. We're both in NATO. In Afghanistan today, we're side by side. You have many more troops than we do, but we have a significant number for us, and we're the third largest supplier of armed forces in the southern part of Afghanistan, which is where the main issues are, the main right. problems with the Taliban.
Why are you there?
We are there for the same reasons as you are. We're there because we want to ensure that there is not a safe haven for terrorists in that country. As our Prime Minister said when President Obama was in Ottawa about 6 weeks ago, he said a threat to the United States is a threat to Canada. So we see ourselves with a very similar interest there.
Is that really true? Now, this is maybe me being provincial or parochial or something, but it seems to me that the United States is a big target.
Absolutely.
For various reasons.
And you're a bigger target than we are.
Precisely. Yeah. Canada doesn't seem to be involved. Canada's like the Switzerland of North America, to me at least. You don't really seem to be involved, and that's, I mean this in a good way, in a lot of the world's animosity. You don't have a target on your back like we do. So if you get involved with the United States in a conflict like Afghanistan, don't you put a target on your back? And why would you do that?
Well, we could. But you can't ignore issues that are out there. We see that this is a potential threat. Bin Laden has mentioned Canada as a target.
Okay.
The United States is the great Satan in the eyes of the people over there. So the target, the United States will always be a bigger target. But we don't want to be seen as a threat. We want to be seen as part of the solution, part of the resolution, part of the protection. Now, one of the other things that we're there in Afghanistan to do is to see some greater development, some greater humanitarian effort in rebuilding a very, very poor country. Mm-hmm. That's with the Soviet presence and then the Taliban governance. They've gone through 25 really, really bad years. So we want to be a part. As part of our foreign aid, Afghanistan is our largest single recipient of foreign aid. So we want to redevelop that country. We want to help them build their governance.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of the corruption there, but you can't do that if you don't have stability, and that's what the armed forces are there for.
Do you get to call some shots, or does the U.S. always take the lead?
If you look at the package that was announced by President Obama 2 weeks ago, and then look at what Canada, the structure of Canada's approach to mm-hmm. Afghanistan, mm-hmm. you'll see there's a significant similarity. Is that by accident? Is it because we had a huge amount of influence? I can't answer that question. What I can say to you is that we were part of the dialogue, the consultation process, the analytical process that went into that review process. So we certainly had some influence on the results.
In this country, we're very concerned about our southern border. Maybe that concern will die back a little bit because our economy is so bad that there may not be as many people who want to come here illegally as they did in the good times. But nonetheless, we share with you an unprotected border, and it's the largest one in the world. We do have border crossings and manned border crossings, but there must be a lot of places where you can cross into Canada or into the United States from Canada where you don't go through a checkpoint if you want to do it illegally. In today's climate, should we be worried about that? Should we be more careful about the fortification between our two countries?
We have a significant amount of cooperation and collaboration regarding the security around the northern border. We have things called the Integrated Border Enforcement Teams. These are U.S.-Canada integrated teams. I sat around the table with them. I can't tell the Canadians from the Americans mm-hmm. the way they talk.
Well, let's say about.
About, or A, unless that's... That's one area where we cooperate.
Right.
We do a lot of work in sharing intelligence. There's good cooperation, particularly around the points of entry. And I think the relationship there probably is as good a level as between any two countries in the world. Now, we do have activities between the points of entry. We have to be concerned of that, both of us. You have guns coming north, which we don't like. You have drugs, and we have drugs going north and south that neither of us like. So we have to be able to work closely on that. We try to do as much of this, stop as much of this stuff away from the border so it doesn't get to the border. But obviously that's a concern that you have. It's a concern that we have. The way to deal with that is through the use of technology. And that's where I think you'll see much more activity in coming years.
I only mean this partially flippantly, but the drugs that are coming to your country from this country are probably the illegal variety, and the ones coming from you are prescriptions, it seems to me.
Well, we have a little bit of the illegal stuff as well, unfortunately.
You have been Canada's ambassador to the United States now since 2006, so you've worked with two different presidential administrations.
Yes.
And we've heard much about the changes that President Obama has made since the Bush administration left office, particularly in the way he wants to handle diplomacy and foreign affairs. You began working with the Obama administration when it was just a transition team.
Right.
What do you see as the differences in the way President Bush operated and President Obama is operating?
At this point, and it's obviously early days, as President Bush said, he wanted to be more collaborative, more open in his dealings with other countries at this stage in his administration as well. Then 9/11 hit and things changed. But towards the end of his administration, there was more of an effort on collaboration, as we've seen with Iran, the six countries involved there with North Korea, six countries involved there in trade negotiations, five countries involved there. So, but it is much more of an open, call it a brand, that President Obama has engendered that in spite of what I just said President Bush was trying to do, the brand never stuck. It never had the impact that the brand that President Obama has put out in a very forthright way and has demonstrated it in the meetings that he had last week. And I think that this past week for President Obama has been a huge diplomatic success.
You come from a conservative government. I believe you were a conservative, more progressive conservative politician.
Well, conservative. Yeah, I was progressive conservative, but it's now called conservative.
And Stephen Harper, your prime minister, is a conservative. And the terms may mean different things in our two countries. And I have about 30 seconds here, but how do you get along with the Obama administration in terms of their outlook, which is more liberal than President Bush's?
I have found in the time that we've been working with them, and even going back before the inauguration, it's been a very good relationship. If you put a conservative government against the U.S. spectrum, it's very close to, it's a little bit to the right of the Democrats.
Michael Wilson's our guest. He's the Canadian ambassador to the United States. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And we'll get back to the final segment of Charlotte Talks in just a moment, made possible in part by the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council, dedicated to viticulture in North Carolina, an industry that produces over 20 different varietals and accounts for 5,700 jobs statewide. Details at visitncwine.com. Well, it's Friday. That means the news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Coming up in the first hour, the Attorney General tries to restore confidence in the Justice Department. The Defense Secretary announces cuts to the Pentagon budget, and hackers may have infiltrated the U.S. electric grid. A panel of journalists joins Diane for analysis of the week's top national news stories. Byron York, chief political correspondent of the Washington Examiner, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, and Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation, all join Diane. This is a pre-recorded interview with Canadian Ambassador Michael Wilson. We won't be able to take your phone calls. Back to the final segment in a moment.
You have many news sources to choose from, but when it's really important that your news is accurate, balanced, and thoughtful, you turn to Morning Edition on WFAE. I'm Scott Graff. On Morning Edition, we're dedicated to keeping you informed and to helping you see the big picture and see how things are connected. It's Morning Edition on WFAE. Hear the whole story each weekday morning from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in conversation today with Michael Wilson, the Canadian ambassador to the United States since 2006. He's worked with President Bush. He's working now with Mr. Obama, President Obama. How has your, given that Mr. Obama's thrust toward more use of diplomacy in the world, how has that changed your job or the way you do your job in Washington?
Well, certainly we're going to take advantage of the stated approach of the Obama administration, and what we are trying to do in the early days is to generate a conversation with a number of the key cabinet secretaries who are our key interlocutors to have a conversation. We've got working groups. We've got an agreement between one secretary and minister where they're going to meet semi-annually, twice a year. So that means that there's a dialogue leading up to those meetings that will allow us to get more things on the table for discussion.
Is the atmosphere different? Obviously, the players are different, and the style and the approach is different. Is the atmosphere different at all?
It is more open in some cases. In other cases, some of the interactions that we had with members of the Bush administration were very open, very productive, very proactive. In other cases, less so. At this point, I think it's a pretty solid, open approach, collaborative approach, lots of discussion.
This is a question out of complete ignorance, and I apologize for it, but at your level, do you deal more with the Secretary of State than you do with the President, or a little of both?
The President and the Prime Minister, they have that primary
relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to crowd that.
So you deal with the Secretary of State?
The Secretary of State.
Then let's talk about Condoleezza Rice versus Hillary Clinton. that was a diplomatic laugh on your part.
There's a lot of similarity between the two.
Really?
Should
they be shocked to hear that?
Well, no, I'm not sure they would be. They're both very bright, very intelligent people. Mm-hmm. When you're in a meeting with them, you can feel that the person there is someone very much in charge, and that was with Condoleezza Rice or now with Hillary Clinton. These are both very strong representatives of a very strong country.
Mm. Can you explain the appeal outside of the United States, the apparent appeal of Barack Obama? He was a rock star at the recent summit.
Yep.
Canadians, I'm told, like him very much and want him to succeed.
Yes.
What is it about Barack Obama, from your point of view?
It's a hard thing to be precise about, but let me give it a try here. The openness that he is approaching the world, I think, is a very important part of it. I think with some countries, they look at an African American and say, I never thought that would happen to the United States. I never thought that they had it in them to have an African American as their president. So there must be something about the United States that I, as the government of whatever other country who's having those views, don't understand. So I want to try to understand about this man and what he means and what this says about the United States of America. There's such a welcome for the man, and we saw that before the inauguration and after the inauguration. He's a very articulate, direct person, mm-hmm. and I think people like that. But he's also someone who is prepared to say, I want to listen to you. And that's part of his reaching out to people. Well, people say, well, I didn't hear George Bush say that to me. Now, maybe George Bush was trying, as I said earlier in the program. But it's much more of the brand of Barack Obama than it was of George Bush. And I think people really, really are responding well to that.
One of the things that President Obama has advocated in some is some sort of improvement to our national health care system in this country. And whenever that comes up, opponents immediately point to France, the healthcare system there, the healthcare system in Great Britain, the healthcare system, God forbid, in Canada. We should go the way the Canadians have to deal with healthcare. Give me a thumbnail of how healthcare in Canada works, who's covered, and the quality of care you receive, and the kind of wait times there are for service.
Well, the who's covered? Everybody's covered. There's a single payer, the government. Those are two fundamental differences. One of the outcomes of this is that the cost of health care in Canada to the country is different. For us, it's about 10% of our annual income, our gross domestic product. In the United States, it's 15, 16, 17%. I'm not sure what the precise number is, but it's in that order of magnitude. So it's at least 50% more costly to provide the health care that you have down here. Mm-hmm. You mentioned wait times. This is probably where we are more of a disadvantage relative to you, because there are wait times.
And by wait times, I mean if I have a problem, I'm going to wait a week or 2 weeks.
Well, you may have if you want to go in for your regular checkup,
mm-hmm.
that may take you longer to get that appointment.
Why?
Than it would, because we don't have the facilities, the number of doctors who will do that work. But if you have a serious condition of whatever, you will get treatment. You'll get treatment in a hurry. But if you have a knee replacement, it may take a few months before that will happen.
You said the government pays for all this. That means the taxpayers
pay
for it.
Does.
So how much higher are your taxes?
Our top tax rate, federal provincial, is 46% in the province of Ontario, where I live when I'm not living in Washington.
And are there provincial taxes on top of that?
No, that's federal and provincial.
Okay, so 46% is the
and
top rate.
And in that, you get your health care. So you're not paying additional.
For the taxpayer, is that cheaper than doing it our way?
Well, for the taxpayer.
Because if you didn't have health care, what would your taxes be, do you know?
I don't know, because I don't have that in the top of my head.
Why
it is in the tax system, so you are paying for it. But look at it from that broad number that I gave you a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
10% of our GDP, it's a little bit less, against 15, 16% for you. It's 50% more expensive here.
Why are drugs cheaper in Canada? Why are Americans phoning pharmacies and making internet connections with pharmacies in Canada to get prescription drugs, because they're cheaper in Canada? Why?
In some cases, if you have a drug plan, you can get your drugs cheaper that way. I think one of the reasons for it is that you have one buyer of those drugs,
mm-hmm.
so that if the drug companies are sitting across the desk from one major buyer, the government, they're not going to be able to negotiate as high a price. That's logical economics.
And when it became apparent that lots of people were crossing the border from the United States into Canada to get their drugs, at first we were discouraged because the drugs couldn't be as safe as they are here in the United States.
Yes.
And then they put the clamps on it. They stopped it.
And we're all dying up there by using the same drugs.
How insulting. I mean, it can't be true.
No,
that has to
true.
Be a bald-faced lie.
Whether you call it what you will, but
you're a diplomat, you can't say that.
It is not an accurate statement. How's that?
That's very good. Both of our nations we share a common birth mother, Great Britain. We've been around for an equally long time. Both of our nations are frontier nations. We carved it out of nothing. And yet we have a lot of gun violence, which people attribute to the Wild Wild West still in this country, and you do not. And in fact, when something happens with a gun in Canada, there's serious ramifications. Correct?
It is, we've had shocks when we've had an inordinate use of guns. And it's normally when it's a pistol, a handgun, that has caused the problems. We have young kids, people when they're in their late teens, early 20s. They're in gangs in some of the bigger cities, Toronto and Vancouver, probably the worst. Those guns come from
here,
the United States. And the impact of that, some of the things that we see happening really is upsetting for a country like Canada.
You have Calgary, you have cowboys. Why don't you have the same mentality? Why are guns not as important to Canadians? Because there are Americans who say, "You take my gun away over my dead body."
Yeah.
You don't hear that in Canada.
No,
do you
don't. I don't know what the answer is. We didn't have the Wild West to the extent that you had down here. If I'm assuming that the movies are a reflection of that. but we have a gun registry in Canada. When that was brought in, there was a lot of opposition from people, particularly people who lived in the rural communities. Mm-hmm. For reasons of control, but also for reasons of cost. Certainly, the concerns that people had on costs were well-founded. This cost a huge amount of money, and people are quite upset as to the cost of the program.
But you can own a gun.
You can own a gun.
What kind of a gun? Can you own an AK-47 in Canada?
No. You can own a rifle.
Aren't the people afraid that the government will come after them and take away their rights if they don't have guns?
Well,
that's what they say here.
The people in the rural communities are very concerned about losing their rights to own a rifle because they use a rifle on the farm.
Sure.
We don't have the difference is that you've had a history where there has been more conflict in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You have more of a military history where many more of your people have gone away to other countries fighting the wars.
And we had a civil war.
And you had the civil war. Right. So that there is an affinity towards firearms. You've used firearms to a much greater extent. I've fired a rifle. I've never had a pistol in my hand. And a lot of people would be in that same way. Well, if I were in the Army, I couldn't say that.
Hmm.
You have more people who have been in the military than we have in our country.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about one difference between our two countries that our country is struggling with and you seem to have come to peace with. Vermont's legislature just legalized gay marriage, but most of the country here is still involved in a very rancorous debate over it. Canada became the fourth country in the world to legalize same-sex marriage nationwide in 2005 with the enactment of the Civil Marriage Act. Why did you move in that direction, and what has been the result?
I think the fundamental reason is human right. Why should not two people of the same sex be able to have a formal relationship, a relationship that's formalized by a marriage? What's the result of it? I think it people just accept that as part of the world that we live in.
You're a conservative politician. This law, as I understand it, came in at a time in Canada when the Liberals ran the government. Are conservatives on board with this?
There's been no attempt to rescind the law.
How do you explain this? Because we are so similar in so many different ways. How do you explain that you are ahead of the United States on what you view and called a human rights issue? Why don't you have a problem with it?
I think it goes back to what we were talking about before. The country is more liberal. Our conservative party is not the same party as the Republican Party.
Why? Why are you more liberal? Are you less religious?
There is more visible religion in this country than we have in Canada. You have more religious television than we would ever have in Canada. Does that make this country more religious? You're more obviously religious than we are.
People say, the opponents to gay marriage say, that you will, by endorsing it, by the government putting its seal of approval or offering at least some sort of a civil arrangement that is equal to what the civil arrangements are in religiously condoned marriage between a man and a woman, that you're opening the floodgates to polygamy and other sorts of things, and you're also destroying the sanctity of marriage. Was that same debate had in Canada?
Yes, no question. We had that debate. Is it leading to polygamy? That is absolutely without any. There's no evidence. No evidence whatsoever.
But if you say it's okay for two men or two women to marry, why isn't it okay for multiple wives or multiple husbands? And if you want to go take it in the opposite route, why wouldn't that?
Well, I see them as quite different things.
So how were you able to get through this conversation peacefully and arrive at this conclusion? Because I have about 30 seconds left.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Two people who are gay, whether they're two men or two women, they didn't choose that. They were born with that in their systems. So why would we hold something against them? And why I don't see the relationship whatsoever to polygamy.
And with that, we have to stop. And this opens a whole can of worms because we can go in a whole different direction. Michael Wilson, Canada's ambassador to the United States, thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Great to be with you, Mike. Thanks for having me.